This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Ioma Iruka's research focuses on early childhood. It's an important period, and it investigates how bias and low expectations shape the experiences of low-income and marginalized children. It's an extremely important developmental period that sets up the foundation for the rest of a person's life. But Ioma barely remembers her first few years. Maybe it's because that was such a busy time for her and her family. Before the age of 8, she had moved from the U.S. to Nigeria and then back to the U.S. again. Today, Ioma Iruka is a research professor of public policy and founding director of the Equity Research Action Coalition Program at the FPG Child Development Institute at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She's also the author of Don't Look Away, Embracing Anti-Bias Classrooms. Ioma Iruka, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Glad to be here.
Well, we talked about moving around a lot those first few years, first 3 years for you in the United States, then back with your family to Nigeria. Do you remember any of that, being in the U.S. or the transition to Nigeria at the age of somewhere around 3, right?
Yeah, around 3. I literally don't remember being in Texas at all. I don't remember the trip back to Nigeria. I don't have a lot of that memory, like some people probably would have.
Well, 3 years old, the first 3 years, you know, that's pretty rough. I don't remember much before I was 4, and most of that I'd like to forget also. Tell us about your first few memories in Nigeria. I mean, what do you remember from being in Nigeria? Because you were stayed then for a few years in Nigeria, right?
Yeah, so I do. I mean, there are some memories I do remember. Like, I remember the school that I went to and the fact that we shared the same latrine with boys and girls. You know, I remember, like, one of my crystal clear memory, and I hope it really is a memory, is one where my parents, we went to the village, our family village. And I remember being dropped off at the village. And all I remember is this man with a sort of basically a skirt on, dancing around with, you know, makeup on his face. And I was literally like, where's my family? Where's everybody? So I have some of these very, buried images around sort of the village experience with my family. I have some experience about school. And my mom working next door at the school. She was a professor at the university right next door. So I have some of those memories. But there's not a lot that I have about my time in Nigeria, which is interesting.
Well, talk about what happened next. Well, it's busy. I mean, going back and forth, 3 years here, then back. And then back to the U.S. with your mom and 2 sisters. And by that time, you're around 7 years old. So why did you move back to the U.S.?
So from what I gather from my mom is that, and my dad, is that in essence, they felt like the American-born children, it was time for us to return back. It was, you know, probably a critical time in the learning period. They wanted to come back. And my mom thought it was important that we come back and, you know, become fully schooled in the U.S. And my dad thought it was good for the American-born kids to, you know, come back and the Nigerian-born kids to stay in Nigeria.
That meant your family had to split up in order to make that work, right?
And that meant my mom had to leave young children behind. So it meant that she had to, you know, take the kids who were born in the U.S. back, and the younger kids who were, I think, my sisters. If I was about 7, some of them were 4 and 3 and 2, had to actually stay in Nigeria with my dad. So it was also my mom having to leave young babies behind, you know, during their own, you know, formative years.
Emotionally difficult and economically too. You mentioned your mom being a professor. Then she moved back with your sisters to Boston. But talk about her experience then and what she had to do to raise you.
Yeah, I mean, it's such an interesting space my mom lived in. I was, you know, so we come back and we pretty much live with, you know, family. And I would say pseudo family, right? They're families that my mom has known for a long time. So we move into sort of this 2-3 bedroom apartment in Boston. And, you know, she's having to work, you know, 3 or so jobs. And so for her going from, you know, probably a comfortable enough life in Nigeria, she has to basically come back and literally start all over. You know, she didn't have a car. She didn't really have money. And she had 3 young kids to take care of. And so I know she had to basically start all of her life over, right? Because she couldn't take her professorship to the U.S., right? It didn't sort of transfer in that way. And so she had to literally start completely over from scratch without, right, the help of my dad. And at the same time, obviously leaving some of her kids behind and, you know, having young kids herself with her.
So what do you remember about that time? And you can say all of that now and see that from your perch now as an adult, but how are you tracking this at the time?
for me, I was like, this is fun. Like, I guess for me, it felt like it was fun for me. You know, it's basically you're having like extended sleepover with people who are your age, right? I had basically my pseudo cousins, my cousins, you know, the boys and the girls. Like, we had fun. You know, we stayed up late. We went to the same school. We walked to school. So it was, to me, in my world, it was fun. Of course, there were moments where I was like, why am I still here? But it was generally fun, at least in the house and in our neighborhood. I think part of my struggle was probably in coming back to the States and then having to enter school and entering school a year ahead. So that meant that I had to sort of do some level of both catch up socially, but also academically, in terms of I was somehow they let me skip a grade. I skipped, I think, third or fourth grade. So I came back with skipping a grade, but I had to still orient to the whole expectations of U.S. schooling and all that kind of stuff. But it was, I think, for me, it's a positive experience in my life.
What about at school? I mean, tell me a little bit more about that academically and socially, trying to fit in. I mean, that does seem like two very different kinds of social orders that you're having to navigate. What was it like in the Boston school system for you?
Yeah, I would say, so I think when we returned, I think I had to just adjust to sort of the language, right? So even though Nigeria is British colonized, right? You know, people speak English, but it's a different kind of English. So I feel like I had to adjust both in terms of my name. So one is just the name alone and people not knowing how to pronounce my name, even though I went with a nickname. It wasn't an American nickname still. So I had to just adjust in terms of just the social part of the school. And just, you know, what was I supposed to be doing versus in Nigeria, people actually went to school all together. You kind of went into sort of this larger space of learning. So I had to adjust to just that part of things. And I think I just had to adjust to like expectations because not like you walk in there with like sort of like, here's how you start school and here's how you sit down and deal with school. And so I think there was some of those just beginnings, you know, that I had to sort of go through those sort of learning periods that didn't happen. And I think just even making friends, you know, who weren't your family. So I think I just going through some of just those natural, you know, developmental stages, I sort of struggled with a little bit. And then on top of that, I wasn't classified as a dual language learner. I mean, looking at it now, I'm like, I should have been, right? In my household, you know, my family, even though I didn't speak the native tongue completely, in the household, they spoke the native tongue. And so I think in many ways, I should have been classified, you know, potentially, but it clearly probably didn't matter. But I always think like I should have been a dual language learner because I actually had other people who spoke a different language other than English in my household. So I think there was some of that adjustment of schooling and some of that adjustment of just being an American again and being a Black American. I think part of that sort of didn't fully come into play until I think a little bit later when I was entering kind of middle school. That's when I think a lot of the racial socialization sort of started hitting pretty directly at that point in time.
Well, tell me more about that and kind of and what you noticed about the difference even in the social strata that you were living in compared to Nigeria's. Social order in school and then even at home, your mother's social status.
Yeah. So I was in Nigeria, right? Everybody's either you're rich or poor or you're either middle class or poor, right? That's kind of the best order you probably have, at least from my memory. And I think here in the States, I feel like after my first couple years, that's when I started realizing, at least I think peers of mine, I think in some ways made it seem like I had to make a choice, right? I remember one of my good friends who lived sort of down the hill, like I lived in the projects. And down the hill actually was sort of the houses that were clearly middle class houses. I didn't know that per se then. And I remember one of my good friends was a white girl, Dina. And we really connected. We were in the same classes, et cetera. But what happened over time, once I ended up going to middle school, is that I was told explicitly, you belong with us, right? I was told by another Black girl. I remember on the bus. And it was clear that moment that was the decision that, you know, I was supposed to be part of a particular group of people. And even though it took me a little bit of time to eventually get there, it was clear there was some of that stratification was happening, especially as I entered middle school where we had to take the bus, right? I should note that before middle school, I could walk to school. I could walk from my, you know, the projects down the hill to my school. But after that, I had to take the bus, which put me in a whole different part of the city. And I think that's where a lot of my socialization probably happened, was on the bus.
What did you make of having to make a choice like that? I mean, on the one hand, you know, there's the sort of what everybody has to do to feel part of their group. But you can also begin to notice a larger kind of social order as a result of that kind of question, right?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I feel like she made it visible, because I mean, a lot of my other friends were actually Black. We were Black single parent household for the most part. So there was already something happening, even though my circle was a bit more diverse. It was kind of already there even before the explicit, like, you belong with us kind of language on the bus. And so I think what just happened is over time, even, you know, when I think about even when we went to the cafeteria, even as we sort of went into sort of the classroom, I mean, it became that a lot of us who were similar, and it happened to be that we were all Black, and some of us actually, a lot of us had the same kind of household of where most of our mothers were single, worked a lot. And so we kind of connected. I don't know if that was intentional, but we sort of just connected and linked. And, you know, and for some of them, we're still actually friends till today. That's probably my closest friends are those I actually met when I was in sort of fifth and sixth grade.
Talking to Ioma Iruka, director of the Equity Research Action Coalition program at the FPG Child Development Institute, and that's at UNC Chapel Hill. She's also the author of Don't Look Away: Embracing Anti-Bias Classrooms. And our conversation will continue on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, spending this hour with Ioma Iruka, director of the Equity Research Action Coalition program at UNC Chapel Hill, author of Don't Look Away: Embracing Anti-Bias Classrooms. She has a unique take on American culture, having spent some of her early years in Nigeria before moving back to the U.S. with her mother and two sisters. And Ioma, I want to get back to your mom a little bit, because she really had to be pretty clever and adept at making the best of what she had. Talk about the ways in which she was able to make the best of her resources.
My goodness, I would say my mom, you know, I probably should tell her this more often. She is definitely a tenacious, persistent person. I would say, obviously, coming back to the States without a lot, she was able to understand how the stock market worked, issues about bond, really, really create a space that said, you know, even if we're poor, we're going to figure out how to get out of poverty. Like, for example, you know, because, you know, she was poor, she was able to access programs. So I feel like I was kept busy most of my high school, my middle high school, all that. The same thing for my sisters, right? Half of my sisters went to private school. And that's saying a lot in the Massachusetts area, right, where you can go to private schools, because she understood sort of like, what does it take to get into private school, and how do you at least leverage the fact that, you know what, you are poor, but there's some potential access in terms of getting your children into some of the best schools. And so I feel like she did a lot in terms of keeping us busy, relying on some of the social services in many ways. I remember, you know, her telling us a story of when she, you know, went to the welfare office, and she said, "I just need food stamps." But they kept on insisting she needed childcare and housing and all these things. And she would take it and then do, you know, probably barter or do something else with it. But she, you know, she worked three jobs. Like, my mom worked three jobs. I literally remember her working three jobs. She'll come home, change, go back. We never saw her, really. She, you know, she didn't come to parent-teacher conferences. But what she didn't make it clear was that our schooling and education was important, right? She would go, she's the one that bought the encyclopedia from the Encyclopedia Traveling Guy. And it's still in my house today, I think, still in my house, my family house in Boston. And so she, to me, sort of took advantage of anything that sort of said helped her understand how does money work in the US, whether it's real estate, whether it's educational opportunities, whether it's scholarships. And so she, to me, leaned in on that. And it probably helped that she, in Nigeria, she was an educated person in Nigeria. And she just happened to come to the States without a lot of financial resources or financial support. But to me, she did work really hard, having to sort of give up a lot of who she was to work so many jobs for her children to be able to eat. I literally remember eating like bread and syrup, literally, for days, you know, getting food from the food bank, right? So those are things that she said in the end of it, she thought it was temporary, and it was eventually. But she leaned in on, I need to make sure that I take these chances, send money back home. I mean, part of my family splitting up was that is to make an opportunity for the rest of our family. So she would literally work, and most of that money would actually go back to Nigeria to take care of her young kids, to make sure that they were doing well. So she had to basically take care of two households. Again, my father did work, but I think, you know, the money in the States stretched a little bit more in Nigeria at that time. So to me, she worked so hard, and she really tried to at least leverage all that she can out of whatever was available for poor people or poor or mothers with young children. And I think that really helped us to be who we are because of her tenacity and her grit. No matter when she got her car stolen, got her credit card stolen, got her license stolen, she always, you know, just figured out what's the next step. What do I need to do to get all this fixed and move on? For her, it was just keep it moving. That's pretty much her motto. Keep it moving.
Which is something that perhaps a virtue that you have embraced going forward. But I wonder at the time, were you internalizing all this? Because kids don't always see it that way when they're kids. And I'm wondering if you internalized that at the time and told yourself, look, she's working hard for this. I got to pay attention in school.
I feel like yes, no. Like, I feel like I must have internalized it because I did enjoy school. I did work on doing well. Like, I did at least make it that her life, at least for me, I wasn't a problem child per se compared to my older sister. So I think I internalized some of that, but I think some of her grit and tenacity, I didn't think that deeply about it. I was like, oh my goodness, mommy's working, who cares? So I think I could have fun. I could get into trouble and she would never know. So I think I didn't internalize it that way, but obviously I must have been another part of my brain, because I do think that's part of who I am in many ways, is to keep it moving, you know, to not let the obstacles stop you from what your destination or your goals are.
And you did enter into the gifted and talented program by middle school, right, in the Boston schools.
Well, yeah, so I did. Well, so we did go into, so I did enter into the exam school. So the Boston Latin School, which is, you know, interestingly, it's in a public school that you take an exam to enter. So I did matriculate into that at seventh grade and on through high school.
And interestingly enough, that's when you started to notice, in particular, Black male students were beginning to taper off in that program or that school.
Yeah, I mean, so I entered seventh grade, and really by that eighth grade, going into ninth grade, that's when I literally, it was like me and my girlfriends were like, wait a minute, what happened to so-and-so? Like, literally between the summer, the spring and coming back to school, the males, the numbers drastically dropped. Like, the ones who were our friends were no longer there. And that's when I literally started noticing, at least for the Black males, it really got reduced. They went to a different school called ABC, I think it was. So yeah, that was a time when you can see that, because we're all in the same grade from seventh grade through 12th grade. So you saw the complete erasing of a lot of the Black males, at least that were my friends, during that time.
Now, your work now centers on some of the reasons why that might be happening. Back then, what did you make of it?
I felt like I was like, they must have been getting in trouble. Like, I literally, I centered it on, it must be their fault, right? It must be, because I mean, I knew them, right? We were all hanging out, you know, some of us good trouble, some of us not so good trouble, right? So I centered it that it must be something going on with them or something going on in their family. That's how I centered what was happening, right? Because I didn't know any better.
What's your sense of it now?
My sense of it is that it was clearly a pattern that was happening that is clearly systematic, right? That the fact that we are clearly, that the males are brilliant enough to get into an exam public school, so they were clearly talented, but something during those experiences led to them not being able to stay, not because of their intelligence or their talent, but because something else was happening to force them to disengage and or be removed and or not be at that school any longer. So for me, I sort of make it out as this is part of how systemic sort of racism and inequities happen, particularly against Black males who to me, when they show giftedness, sometimes I believe is a fear. And in some ways it gets turned on them. And so they may not appear as gifted to some people, but clearly they are. And I think a lot of times the system is not set up to really help support and nurture them in a way that meets their needs. And so either because of biases that exist or because of society writ large, they get removed from these opportunities that they have earned, but clearly is not maintained over time. So I see it much differently now based on, again, looking back at that time and seeing that pattern that clearly was there, but I put on them and not the school or the system that clearly continued to have them leave, or at least not be there after like ninth or 10th grade.
Well, I'm curious to know how you came to that observation from that place where you were in middle school. Let's talk a little bit about what comes next. You decided at an early age to pursue your doctorate. Talk about your decision to continue in school, where you wanted to go and what you wanted to pursue.
Yeah, you know, I always knew I was going to get a PhD. Like, I feel like even my math teacher in high school, like, you're going to be Dr. I squared. I just think that part of what I internalize about my family is like, you're going to go to high school, you're going to graduate, and you're going to get a degree, right? And a terminal degree. Like, for me, I internalize that completely. And so for me, high school was just a bump in the road. And part of that was I had to figure out what is it I'm going to do. And I knew psychology for whatever reason. Psychology was what was in my head. And my questions really in going after it was to understand why is it that some of my friends made it and why did some of us not make it? That was literally that was my question. And what is it about the families, right? This is again me not knowing any better by saying, what is it about the families that didn't allow my friends to make it through Boston Latin School, and sort of again position it on the fact that it must be their fault, right? It must be the students or the family's fault. And I think that is sort of my first foray into that. And I think over time, as I've to me unlearned what I would say are really biased way of thinking about groups of people, I have relearned and understood about how the system actually operates, right? That certain groups of people, unfortunately, are always positioned as less than, lower than. And that creates a narrative that I think is perpetuated by even those who are within that same community until we can do something different and better. And so for me, my degree getting was to answer those questions, even if it was naive and ridiculous at
Well, I
some
mean, it's
point
an
in time.
important step along the way. If your assumption is there's something wrong with you, let me go study how your brain works and how your mind works so we can fix all of you. And then you study it and say, you know, the more I look into this, the more I realize. And so you come to that from a real place of knowing and then say, so what else is it? And that takes you to where you are now. But I want to take not to skip too many steps along the way, because you decided to go to Temple in Philadelphia, right? Temple University. Talk about that decision, and we'll talk more about your experience there.
Yeah, I decided to go to Temple because I wanted to get away from Massachusetts. It was cold. It was boring. It was time for me to go. I wanted to go somewhere. And at that time, Bill Cosby was there. And I remember him, you know, watching the Cosby Show. And I was like, Temple looks like a great school. And I mean, sadly, sometimes that was as simple as it got. Temple was a great school.
That's where he went, and that was before his fall from grace. So all of that is well understood. What about your experience? Because you got an athletic scholarship. You rowed, right? You were on the crew.
I was on the crew team. I know I literally was in the gym working out, and the crew coach saw me and said, "Hey, you look like you could row." I said, "Okay," and I tried out, and yes, and I got Atlanta scholarship on the crew team, and that was an amazing experience because number one, black people in boats don't always go well together, so that's one thing. And two, we're on the water at 5 o'clock in the morning, right? And you know, so but to me, that was actually a really important point in my life because I literally started, I had my academic scholarship, et cetera. But my first semester was, I wasn't the greatest student. I was busy being what a student would do when they are free. My GPA was like 2.75 or something like that. It was terrible. So the crew coming in a year, the next semester, a year later, helped to organize me, right? It helped to give me the structure that I really needed. It helped to give me a purpose too, that I'm part of a team and I have a job to do on my team. And it really gave me another community to be a part of that wasn't sort of the typical sort of, you know, black person on campus. It gave me another set of team members to be a part of. And it made me my stay at Temple longer than it should have been. I was gonna leave in my 2 years later. But being part of the crew team helped me to stay at least another year because I could really experience being a student athlete at a Division One university.
It's
So
and
it was so my yeah, it was fun.
a rare form of teamwork. I rowed in high school, and it's just the best sport in the world, as far as I'm concerned. But the thing you learn is that talk about teamwork. I mean, you really have to be one organism, but you're an individual, and everybody knows if you're pulling your weight or you're not as an individual. And the boat works as an organism. It's amazing. Good stuff.
I really enjoyed it from the Susquehanna to, you know, the Potomac. I mean, yes, I definitely enjoyed that part of my college career.
Now, you moved off campus in your third and final year at Temple, that's talk about that decision and what that did, how your understanding began to shift a little bit.
Well, first of all, they threw us out because they didn't have any more spaces. I mean, so say they so the university was like, get out, you're older now. So they did move us off campus. And I think that gave me sort of, I think that's why I really wanted to leave then, because I felt like now I'm an adult. I had my own apartment, even though it was with two other roommates that the university paid for it through our scholarships. But it really gave me that sense of, I now really want to be free. I want to do more. I want to learn more. I want to see more. I even had a car, like an old 1987 Toyota Tercel then too, that my mom had gotten from me. So I was literally in freedom and I wanted more of that. And I felt like the university was holding me back.
So you went, you also had some experiences in Philadelphia that gave you a sense. I mean, you know, you started to understand how racial hierarchy and dynamics were working in the United States. You had a clear understanding of that, but things really came clear for you, I understand, in Philadelphia.
Yeah, I mean, so Temple is in North Philadelphia, and then during that time, it really was a blighted. Other than the university being there on Broad Street, it was just a reminder about the Black people who were poor. And it felt to me, it was just, for me, it was a little bit of guilt that here I was at this university, a Black person, and I was able to live in these great apartment halls. And literally I could see from my dorm window, all the Black people in the boarded up apartments and townhomes. And it just, for me, it was actually depressing, right? I mean, there was the great times, but it was depressing. And I wanted to get away. I don't want to be reminded of my community being in such to me, what looked like a state of poverty, even though there was happy. I mean, I went to parties in some of those places, but it just did not feel like it was full happiness. And I didn't want to be reminded of that. That was really one of the reasons I wanted to leave Temple and leave Philadelphia specifically. Interestingly, my husband, he also went to Temple. And for different, whatever, we have the same sort of feelings. We wanted to get away because of the reminder of the experiences of Black people, both in terms of poverty, but just in terms of the law enforcement. And it was some of those reminders were part of the reasons I was trying to literally rush out of college.
Out of college, somewhere else. Out of Philadelphia to South Florida, where it's really going to be warmer. So there's good news there. And you're taking a job as a social worker, right? But it seems to me, you know, you talked about wanting to sort of get away from these visions that were difficult to see, and yet you take a job as a social worker specializing in infantile and child sexual abuse cases. That had to be tough work.
That was my first real job, because when I finished Temple, I actually went back home to Boston because I didn't want to work a full-time job. But when I knew it was time for me to leave Boston, after my master's, I went to Miami. And my first job was being a social worker. And I didn't have control of my caseload. But, and my caseload was, you know, I met, you know, the grace of parents who were struggling to get their kids back, but who also have done some atrocious things, either directly or indirectly to their young child. But what made me get through that was the notion that I knew this wasn't permanent, right? Like, I think there's something about knowing that you can do your best and fight your hardest when you know that this is not going to be forever. But it was really hard to read the cases themselves, to see the kids themselves, but also to understand how the court systems work, particularly if you're poor, right? If you're a person of color, and mind you, I'm in South Florida, I'm in the Broward County area. So we're talking about a lot of both families of color, families who are immigrants, families who don't speak English as their first language. So you're talking about a system that pretty much churns you in many ways. And the hope is that, and part of it is taking your child away, right? That's part of taking your child away because of some level of substantiated abuse. And it was hard, but I knew that I wasn't going to be there forever. And I think that's what made me get through it. That's what I think in some ways I thrived in that space. I became an interim supervisor, who'd have thunk it, at 20, what was I, 20? I just turned 21 maybe. And so because I knew that wasn't my death, that wasn't my conclusion, that wasn't my destiny, but it was a place that I learned a lot, both about the ability of young children to even thrive, even in the midst of such trauma. And I learned that from the young kids, and I learned that from the system that I worked in, the child welfare system in South Florida.
Well, talk about what you did with those experiences, because you got your doctorate at the University of Miami. What research were you interested in at that time?
So I actually took the interest I had was from high school still. Like, I wanted to understand, what is it about families that makes children be better, right? Like, it literally is like, because I was still thinking it was all about the families, right? The reason why my friends got kicked out of school or didn't make it through Boss Lion School is because it must be their family. And that was still the underlying thing that I did at Miami, was to understand families and parenting, especially those who are living in poverty, like myself and my family. So that was the underbelly. That's the undercurrent of my work, was really around families and parenting. And that guided a pretty much my whole entire work at the University of Miami.
We'll talk about that work and where it led you when my conversation with Ioma Iruka continues, a research professor of public policy, director of the Equity Research Action Coalition program at UNC Chapel Hill, and author of Don't Look Away, Embracing Anti-Bias Classrooms. Our conversation continues in a moment. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Ioma Iruka's biography spans two continents, spent some of her early formative years with her family in Nigeria before moving back to the U.S. with her mom and two sisters. She grew up in Boston, spent some time in Philadelphia for college, got her doctorate in South Florida, and today is a researcher at UNC Chapel Hill and director of the Equity Research Action Coalition at the FPG Child Development Institute. Also the author of Don't Look Away, Embracing Anti-Bias Classrooms. So we talked about getting your doctorate and looking again, still trying to think about families and how, and your doctorate in psychology. But then you went into the private sector briefly after getting your doctorate. Tell us about that.
Oh, yes. My idea was, I don't want to be a faculty. I don't want to be in a university. I want to just go make money. And so I went to this research firm in Rockville, Maryland, Westat, and but then I realized probably 3 months in, maybe a little less than that, great work we were doing was a federal contract agency. But I was like, oh my goodness, I need autonomy. I need creative outlets. I need to be back at academia. Like I learned pretty in 3 months, I needed to kind of leave. I did stay for 9 months until sort of the postdoc at UNC opened up. But yeah, it was, I'm glad I did it. I still have connections from there, but it definitely taught me that that wasn't a space that I belonged in at that point in time.
Well, tell us more about the decision to come to UNC to do that postdoc.
Yeah, I would say, you know, in many ways, I always tell people I credit a lot of my professional space that I situate in to really my postdoc and my mentoring that I received at UNC. You know, like I was mentored by, you know, Dr. Donna Bryant and Dr. Peg Birchinell, you know, and to me, they were the two sort of amazing people who were well known in the space of early childhood, along with Oscar Barbara. And so I felt like I was in this space that was affirming, that gave me such great confidence, but also gave me such great opportunities. You know, I was at the Frank Porter Graham Child Development Institute, which is known really for a lot, one of the seminal studies in early childhood called Abecedarian. And so I was in this really internationally well-known institute, but I was also one of very few Black people. So good or bad, in many ways, I think that gave me a level of visibility, but also level of opportunity to really be able to connect with a lot of the researchers, both at the Institute, but also across university. And I think when you're a postdoc, the idea is that you're a postdoc, you don't really know what you're supposed to be doing. So it gave me such freedom to just learn, to grow. And it was also a space where I was truly, I would say, truly affirmed and provided with a lot of opportunities. Whether or not I was ready or not, I don't know. But I was given a lot of opportunities to really be in a space of research and policy work. And I feel like the postdoc helped to situate me there. And I ended up staying. Like, mind you, I grew up in Boston. Nobody goes below the Mason-Dixon line, as they tell you. But but I enjoyed being at UNC, and I stayed until 2014. So I literally started my postdoc, and you know, 2 years later I was in a research position, and I stayed there for six more years. So I really, a part of who I am will always be connected to UNC and FPG specifically.
Actually, the trick at UNC and Duke for getting Harvard professors to come down here is to recruit them in January. And then they bring them down, take them to the restaurant, say, well, your flight's been canceled back to Boston because of the snow. But tell us more about that. Is this the point at which your postdoc now, is this where you're beginning to reevaluate some of your early convictions about whose fault it is and the responsibilities for some of what you saw in middle school?
So I feel like it took a little bit. I feel like my postdoc was, it was the beginning was starting, because now I'm starting to kind of connect with systems in early childhood. But I think it's really when I got pregnant. I think when I got pregnant with my first child in 2012, So this is basically, I'm already, what, 5, 6 years into, I've done my postdoc and now in a permanent position at UNC. And I think it's really when I became pregnant. And I would say maybe it's hormones. I don't know what happened, but I know that the journey of where I literally start to, I would say, actually unlearn some of my thoughts about whose fault was who. I began to actually really study the policies and the history of the US, right? I went to one of the best, I want to point out, I went to one of the best schools in the whole entire country. Boston Latin School has produced a lot of presidents. And there were things I did not learn. And I would say even the universities, there are things I did not learn. I did not learn fully about the history of the US. I didn't really delve deep into some of the systemic inequities. I didn't do that till actually I was about to have a baby. And I think my want to make sure that my child had the best life was really part of the uncovering of that some of the things that I have been doing, some of the ways I focus my research was really not going to be helpful to her life or those who look like her. So I think in some ways the hormones kicked in. That's literally what happened.
You
Part of
but
that is literally what happened.
I mean, I have a lot of faith in the ability of hormones to teach wisdom, but now were you also doing a little research into these systems at the
I know, just a little bit. I know a little bit. I mean, I think I feel like I was still, I was doing work with the system, but it wasn't with what I would consider much more of this open, wide eye. I was kind of still working on, how can we make the system stronger? How can we create better, high quality programming for children for poor households? How could we, it was all, it wasn't really about uncovering why do we even have this system? Why do we have poor people? Why do we have certain groups of kids that are always poor? Why are the parents still struggling even after they have these services? So it was, my questions were still, in some ways, still targeting this individualistic kind of sense. But I do think that, I think as my focus on sort of black boys, especially my work that was Kellogg funded with a group of scholars, Donna Marie and Oscar Barbarin, I think as I ventured into some of that work around black boys, and it wasn't even the work itself, it was the response of school people and families in those schools who basically were using the N-word and were asking, why are we even focusing on black boys at all? It was this vitriol actually that helped me really understand that something was amiss here. Like that something that us just focusing on black boys would bring such level of vitriol was actually shocking to me. And here I was, a black woman in the South. That was actually, I think, the beginning of the wake up call that is not so much about the boys themselves, but it was more about that things have to be done in a way that opens up our lens as to why is it that these group of boys are struggling, even when there's evidence that they're pretty brilliant. Why are they struggling? This should not be the case. So that was, to me, it was some of that work was helping to open up my eyes, along with, I think, about to be a mom.
So, along with his awakening at a certain point, you're here at UNC, but then you decide to move to Nebraska, Omaha, Nebraska, for a while. Talk about that decision and what you did there.
Yeah, I had my child and I felt like I wasn't doing, I felt like I wasn't connected to the work. I felt like I was too far removed from children. I was too far removed from families. I wasn't sure if the work I was doing was actually impactful. I think I wasn't sure. I just wasn't. And so when I was called by, Sam Mizell's, he was developing a whole new institute funded by, the Buffett and the University of Nebraska. They were like, you can do some things here. You can see it because we're so small. And I was like, yeah. And so I think the call to want to feel the work was the reason why I decided to go to Nebraska, where I was like, is there any black people in Nebraska? But I
Are
think it was my yeah, are there are there are, actually
there?
there was
You've
a
been there.
great number of black people.
Okay, good.
Yes. Yeah, it was definitely for me, it was I want to just feel much more connected in a visceral way, in an emotional way, in a physiological way to the work that I was doing. I want to feel it on the ground more than I did when I was at UNC.
So you did work there, and but you did come back. You've been here, came back in October, right?
I came back in 2017,
27.
July of 2017.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually been back for a little while.
All right. So talk about that decision then to come back. A little bit about what you did there and kind of what was happening in Nebraska and then what brought you back.
Yeah, Nebraska was a fun place, I must say. My daughter was 15 months when we moved to Nebraska. My son was born in Nebraska. It was very family friendly, but of course, that's where you realize that's the middle of the country. There was a big black community that I loved that embraced me completely. But it was also a level of dehumanization, I think, of black people, especially even those who were educated were working jobs like being administrative assistants, and they had master's degrees. So it was challenging. But the work I did there really helped me to understand how policy really works. Meaning that it wasn't just about how smart you were or what evidence you had, but is that you had to get it in the right hands in the right way. It had to be the right messengers. It had to be at the right time. And you had to be thoughtful about your communication. I didn't learn any of that in my grad program, I must say. So it was actually a great place to be because you had a unicameral, which meant there was one house. And so you were able to really connect with the governor, with the senators, with the advocates, and you were part of the university. And to me, that was a beautiful way to understand how research truly impacts policy and truly impacts practice, because it was so small, you can actually see it and feel it. And that was really important. But it was also a place where I began to sort of question, what can we do for Black and brown people that also benefits white people? Like I had some of my greatest conversations about policy with older white males in Nebraska. And that allowed me to really lean into the issue of anti-racist policies and programming. And how does that benefit white people too, right? Beyond Black and brown people. So that was a space that I'm glad that I went to and I learned. But, you know, after having my son, my husband was like, it's time to go back to the East Coast. So, you know, there's some, you know, certain things about the East Coast that, you know, you just feel more comfortable and more affirming with, just because the Midwest is for certain people. And we were East Coasters. He's from Florida. I'm from Boston. We're East Coast people. So and North Carolina was the space we felt we can grow our family, that allowed us to also be ourselves and to try to do our work, him as an investor, me as a researcher, and have a strong, diverse set of community people around us. And North Carolina is very diverse, and that was important to us and our kids.
Well, let's talk about what you learned and some of your observations and how you can meet some of the objectives. How can we create a more equitable society that actually works for everybody? Talk about your observations and where we can take this research. What should we be doing? What should we be focusing on?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that's where we are as a country. I think that in some ways, the, you know, coronavirus, the pandemic that we're in, is sort of giving us a way. How do we talk about racism? Is the same we talk about COVID-19, that we kind of have to all be in it together, right? Racism may unfortunately really, really harm and affect, say, Black and brown people and indigenous populations, but it also affects white people. So with COVID-19, we see the disproportionality with Black and brown and indigenous and native communities, but it also affects white people. And for us to really address that kind of pandemic, we have to literally be in it together. And I think that at least the work that I am doing and uncovering is that, you know, policies matter. And policies have to attend to the needs of those who really need it the most. And that to do it in a way that only privileges some is not helpful. And that we have to do it in a way that brings a lot of voices at the table, right? Like, don't create a program or a policy where you haven't thought about somebody like me or somebody like my kids, because it means you're doing a policy that literally removes our experiences. And so to me, part of the work that I'm trying to be part of and trying to shape is that the work has to center in some ways race and racism, right? Racism literally is part of the U.S., is literally the fabric that we, that the U.S. is made of. And we have to acknowledge that part. And to me, you have to acknowledge that part, acknowledge the pain that has been there, that continues to be there. But we have to realize if we can see the pain forward, and literally see it for what it is, that we can actually, once we get through the pain part, we can actually move forward. And I think because we haven't fully acknowledged the pain, the agony, and all the trauma, we continue to sort of see revisited in all these various circles, whether inside of schools, inside of communities, during the COVID-19, because we haven't fully acknowledged the pain and agony we have created and caused to some communities, particularly Black communities. And I think until we really, I think, own that, it'll be hard to fully move forward with this open arm, ready to work together, collective. But I think it's possible. But we have to sort of start now.
But let me ask you about that, because some would say that it is precisely the fact that we're getting closer to feeling that pain, particularly, well, for Black and white communities, for Black, brown, and white communities, that that particularly when white communities are beginning to feel the pain, that's what has created the division. In other words, it's precisely running away from the acknowledgement of that and being brought so close that's created these really ironclad sort of iron curtain divisions. So, I mean, maybe I'd ask your prescription for that, but maybe the better question is, can we move forward and undo some of these structures without having sort of to undo the Constitution? Because it feels like that conversation may be a long way off, given the aversion that so many people have to feeling the pain that you're describing.
And that's why, you know, the book Don't Look Away is literally like, we cannot look away, right? And I think that part of what we have to do is, yes, we may not be able to make some massive wholesale systemic changes right now. I do think that we have to take the little steps, right? We have to take the steps of having these conversations. We have to take the step of interrogating, even like for me in my world of research, interrogating the research that we have done, the research I have done, I've had to interrogate, right? And so part of that is the question, why did I do these set of research? What positive effects have they had, or what negative or have they had? And so to me, we have to take these steps, and it's actually great to see some of the steps being taken where people are asking, you know, for example, in early childhood, we're asking, what is the history of early childhood? What can we do different to make sure that it's accessible and affordable and of the highest quality to meet the needs of children, especially Black children, because early childhood was built literally on the backs of Black children. And so I do think taking some of these steps that eventually, whenever time comes, when it could be a full-throated dismantling of the racist structure, we'll be ready for that. But before all that happens, we do have to take these really important critical steps and have these critically important conversations that are really, really hard, right? I know nobody wants to have these questions, this conversation about racism. They're ready to talk about poverty, right? But not race and racism. But if we are not having those, we will never get to the point where we talk about policies and what are anti-racist policies, what are policies that repair the historical harm and actually put people forward and move forward in sort of a humane way. But it means that we actually have to have these cross-racial conversations. We have to sort of lean in and not look away from when we're engaging these conversations. We have to just be present. And I think that's been important. To me, that's been an important progress I actually have seen, is all the conversations I've been a part of, you know, is that we're actually having these conversations, white, Black, Latino, Natives, having these conversations that we literally only had in our small sort of secure circles. But that is the beginning. And I'm hopeful that it'll be better in my kids' lifetime, in my grandkids' lifetime, that it's not going to just be conversations, but it will eventually be acts, and acts that become policies, that policies become the way that we operate. But, you know,
thank you for this conversation, Ioma Iruka, research professor of public policy at UNC Chapel Hill. And thanks for listening to The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow.